Gotcha. Okay, so we're going into today's solvation and ionophores, and then we're going to get on to acidity, probably not by the end of the lecture. What's going on here? Okay, first the answer to the puzzle from last time. Remember, how do you get an aldehyde from this reaction with the N-chloro compound? Well, one possibility is you could do the free radical chain reaction at the other position, the one we didn't show last time. So you get free radical substitution at that position. And then if there's a base, as there always is, you can do this elimination reaction that we've talked about before, and you have the aldehyde. So that's one way to get it. Substitution by a free radical chain and then elimination. And note that the base that removes the proton could be a really weak one, right? There's almost always something in there that has an unshared pair that can do the job. It could just be the alcohol itself. Could be the anion from dissociation of sulfuric acid. Remember, this is done in sulfuric acid. The particular case was 30% sulfuric acid. But this might fail with 30% H2SO4 because the free radical chain might terminate. So maybe it's not that mechanism. A more likely one involves a HOMO and LUMO. So where do we have a HOMO on this one? Somebody help me out. Madeline? Unshared pairs on the oxygen. How about a LUMO? Somebody got a candidate here? Yeah, Brian? Pardon me?
Sigma star NCl.
Sigma star NCl is going to be the lowest one. It could be sigma star NH too. But if it were sigma star NH, you'd put a proton on the oxygen, but then the amine you generated would take the proton back again. It wouldn't go anyplace. Okay, so if you use the one you said, the NCl, then you could do this reaction. And now again, you got the chlorine on there. There's an extra proton, but the nitrogen can take that one off. Okay, so we got this compound. But now we that's the same compound we had above, right? So again, you can use a base, take it off, and generate the double bond. So there are two ways to do it, and probably in the 30% sulfuric acid, it's the second way, not the free radical reaction. Okay, that was the problem for today. Now we're into chapter 6 in the book, which has to do with Rx. Where X is a halogen, or it could be an alcohol, or an ether, the H could be an R, or an amine with two hydrogens, or H and R, or two Rs, or sulfur with H, or with an R. Okay, now, one of the important reactions we'll talk about here, especially with the alcohols and the thiols, the ones with sulfur, are the ionic chemistry, the dissociation is an acid, so pKa. And that will continue in chapter 7 with ionic chemistry. But another theme that's in this chapter is these things acting as solvents. And in fact, for any ionic reaction, a solvent is really key. And that's what we're going to start talking about today. So what forces are involved? Well, there's the electrostatic force is what's important. We talked about this last semester. Gravity and magnetism are so weak that they don't make any difference in chemistry. And the strong force that holds the nucleus together is for physicists. So the only force we really have to deal with is electrostatic. So how about the electrostatic interaction between things in solvents and the solvents themselves and among the solvent molecules? So nice for us, the theory of organic chemistry is manageable because often it's possible to look just at the molecule or molecules that are reacting and ignore the solvent. That is, look only at the strong actions, the bonds and so on, and not the non-bonded interactions between molecules. The nice thing about bonds, as we've studied last semester, is that they make well-defined distances, well-defined angles, so there are very few structures you have to deal with. If you're dealing with weak interactions between things, they're not so directional and not so fixed in their distance. So there are lots and lots of different structures. You can't talk about a tetrahedral carbon analog when you're talking about a solvent. And there are many more of them, many more non-bonded interactions. So it's very complicated when you have to consider it in detail. Often we don't have to consider it in detail. We can get the general idea just looking at the molecules themselves and not at the solvent. We always have to keep in the mind, back of our mind, that the solvent is crucial. And the weak interactions actually give organic materials many of their most valuable properties. The reason you want organic molecules is typically not for their reactivity, but for the physical properties they have. And changes in physical properties typically involve very small amounts of energy. If they required large amounts of energy, they wouldn't happen at equilibrium. So it's not like breaking bonds or something like that. It's these small energies that can be involved in intermolecular non-bonded interactions that make a lot of difference in life in general. Okay, so we should think about this a little bit, about the non-bonded, the classical energies. It's the electrostatic energy, not talking about quantum mechanics here. Okay, so the most fundamental one is the interaction between charge, and that's Coulomb's law, where we started last semester. And it's the only source of true potential energy in chemistry, any significant amount of potential energy, and we saw that when we got into quantum mechanics. And it's proportional to 1 over R, the energy. Now, the proportionality constant is 332.2 kilocalories per mole. So divide that by the distance and you get the energy. So at a bonded distance, 1 to 2 angstroms, this is hundreds of kilocalories per mole, right? Really, really strong. Right? So, and it gives rise to long-range attraction. Remember, bonding doesn't go very far because overlap falls off quickly as atoms move away from one another. But this goes on for a great distance. It's just 1 over R. Right? So you can have attraction between ions or repulsion between ions at substantial distance from one another. Now, the thing that makes it possible to overcome these barriers is that, as I said, you have a solvent, right? And if you have a dielectric constant, so-called, of the solvent, that mitigates the strength of the interaction. In fact, you divide by that epsilon, that dielectric constant. Now, how big are these dielectric constants of solvents? How much does it attenuate this hundreds of kilocalories per mole? Well, they can be quite substantial. Here are values, some of them taken from table 6.7 in the book, some from elsewhere. And you see for water, it's 78. So order of magnitude 100. So so 332 divided by 78 is about 4, right? So it so if you're in water, this energy of interaction of ions is only about 4 kilocalories per mole, rather than 332 kilocalories per mole. So in water, it's possible to get ions apart rather easily. Now, there are other things that also have substantial dielectric constants. For example, the second one there, dimethyl sulfoxide, has about 50. And methanol and ethanol are a little bit lower. Ethanol is smaller than methanol because it doesn't have as many polar things in there. The way, of course, the dielectric constant works is that you have positive and negative you're trying to get apart, but if you put something in between that can put its positive near the negative and its negative near the positive, that lowers the energy. So by orienting the molecules that are in between, or even if they're not polar, if you can distort the charge in them so that the positive goes one way and the negative goes the other, that also lowers the energy from interaction of the ions. So ethanol doesn't have as many polar things, as high a fraction of polar things as methanol does, so it's 25 as opposed to 33. If you go to acetone, you get down a little bit lower still. Chloroform is only 5. Ether is a little bit polar, but not very much, only 4. And N-hexane is 2. Air or vacuum is 1. Okay, that's the original Coulomb's law, when you have air in between. So without one of these solvents that's a polar or polarizable solvent, it's very difficult to do ionic reactions where you have to get ions apart from one another. That's not working. Okay, now, so you have charge-charge interactions. There's also interaction of charge with things that aren't charged but are dipolar, like the OH group in the alcohols that we just talked about. Now, this is simply a generalization from the one above, charge-charge. You can treat the dipole as if it were two charges, a negative charge and a positive charge, and they, of course, oppose each other's influence on the other positive charge. Right, so they largely cancel, but one is a little bit closer. So how big a dipole is depends on how big these charges are and how far apart they are from one another. That will determine how different their influence is. So that's proportional to 1 over r squared. So it falls off more rapidly. You don't have such long-range interaction between dipoles. First, the dipoles are weaker because you have the canceling of charge effects. It's only the difference of the distance that gives you any net effect at all. And then it falls off more rapidly with distance, so it's a lot weaker. Okay, now also the dipole could reorient. Right? So if you have a situation where the dipole is in a solvent and it can flop around, you only get an effect to the extent that it's preferentially aligned in the favorable as opposed to the unfavorable way. And under those conditions, it depends on temperature, because the lower the temperature, the higher fraction will be lined up in a favorable way. Right? So it's then r to the minus fourth over temperature, so falling off even faster. Okay, originally it's R2 if you know the orientation of the dipole. Now, even if the thing is nonpolar, in the presence of the charge, it can distort. So this is like correlation energy that we talked about before. So this is charge interacting with an induced dipole and has to do with how polarizable that non-charged species is, right? That's r to the minus 3, so it falls off even faster with distance. And then you can have two dipoles interacting with one another, and that's also r to the minus 3. Or you can have induced dipole, and that's correlation energy that we talked about before, and that's r to the minus 6. So the charge-charge, not surprisingly to any of you, is a much longer range effect than any of the others. But all of them can play a part, and we've seen that one in correlation energy. And that's what I said. Okay, now let's look at the methyl halides and just look at some trends here. First, look at the van der Waals radius of the X group, hydrogen, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, iodine. No surprise, it gets larger as you get further down the periodic table. Let's also look at the bond distance between X and CH3. And this is actually amazing that those two lines fall so much on top of one another. I mean, there's no fundamental reason they should do so, but they're really very close. That is, non-bonded distance, the van der Waals radius, is about twice as big as the bonded distances. Okay, so that just makes it easy to correlate. But now remember, we said that the dipole moment has to do with how big the charge is and how far apart the two charges are. And the interesting thing about that is it's not monotonic. It goes through a maximum. Why? because there are two different things that are determining it. One is the distance between the atoms that are involved, the X and the CH3, and the other one is how much charge is transferred. Now, we can, since we know the distances from above, we can make an estimate of how big the charges are by dividing the dipole moment. Okay, so that in Debye units, which is what dipole moments are measured in, it's 4.8 times how many electrons have been transferred from one to the other times their separation in angstrom. So we just divide, and we find that this non-monotonic dipole moment actually relates to a quite linear charge difference between X and CH3. So it's only a small amount of electrons transferred, like 0.3 to 0.2 electrons are effectively transferred to generate this dipole moment. That's how polar the bonds are. But the dipole moment being the product of two properties, one of which is increasing the distance and one of which is decreasing the dipole moment, can show funny behavior, especially if one of them is nonlinear. And the bond distances are not linear, right? There's a jump when you go from fluorine to chlorine. So that gives rise to that maximum. These two things are opposing one another, but fluorine is unusually small. So when you see a trend like this as you go through the elements that's non-monotonic, it implies that they're conflicting non-linear trends. Okay. So we can see the same thing we actually did mention the same thing last semester in terms of these A values. How big is a group? How much does it prefer to be equatorial rather than axial in a cyclohexane ring? Remember, this was a measure of substituent size, and here are the values. And again, it's not monotonic. It rises to chlorine and then falls off as you go bromine and iodine. Why? Because there are two things going on. So there's some competition. In the case of fluorine, the atom is small and the bond is fairly short. When you get to bromine, however, although the atom is much bigger, the van der Waals radius is much bigger, the distance that it stands off from the carbon is also bigger, so it doesn't make such a big influence on the difference between axial and equatorial. So that's why there are these two things going on, which is how you get a maximum. So it's got a larger van der Waals radius, but it stands off further. In this connection, it's interesting to compare methyl. So methyl, of course, isn't spherical. But if you approximated the spherical in terms of what its size would be, people use a value that makes it just a little bit bigger than bromine. You can see space-filling models here. Methyl on the left, bromine on the right. So methyl is just a little bit bigger than bromine. So what would you expect for the axial versus equatorial of methyl? If you were naive, you'd say it should be pretty much like bromine because they're about the same size. Why won't they be like that? Why will, yeah. Right, the carbon bond is much shorter than the bromine bond. So there's the bond distance for carbon to carbon rather than bromine to carbon. And if you look at the pictures there, you could watch it shorten when I put carbon in. Right, so in fact, the A value for methyl group as compared to the halogens is much larger, because although it's not significantly bigger than bromine, it's very much closer in where it interacts more with in those 1,4 van der Waals interactions. Okay, now here are boiling points of the alkyl halides, and in particular, let's look first at the methyl. From methane, methyl, fluoride, chloride, bromine, iodide, and the boiling points go up a lot. Now, what is it that raises a boiling point? Obviously, from the point of view of entropy, molecules would rather get apart from one another because they have many more possible positions to be in. Okay, but that entropy that tends to make them fly apart is the countervailing tendency is the molecules holding together. So in fact, what we're looking at here is how strongly these molecules hold together with one another. Right. So methane is the smallest. Now, what could be holding the other ones together more tightly than molecules of methane? What force holds? It's not bonds, right? It's non-bonded interactions. Derek? It could be correlation energy that the electrons are fluctuating in phase with one another. But that's not the biggest effect. Yeah. Yeah, it could be dipoles. Remember, these molecules, the ones with halogens, have a separation of positive and negative charge, so they can line up, which is a longer range distance, longer range force than the induced dipole case is the correlation energy. Okay, so that can explain why methyl fluoride is much higher, 90 degrees almost, or 80 some degrees higher boiling than methane is, because it has a dipole moment of 1.85 debis, where methane has zero dipole moment. But if that were the total explanation, if it were dipoles lining up to hold the molecules together, then, so if that were the force, then we wouldn't expect this, because the dipoles, you see, maximize, as we saw in the last slide, at chlorine, and then fall off for bromine and iodine, but the boiling points keep going up. So it's not just that they're dipoles holding things together. What could be the source now? Let's go back to Derek again. Now it's correlation energy, right? The more electrons you have and the fuzzier they are, the further out, the more they're polarizable. So iodine that has a lot more electrons can profit from that. So if we look at a table of polarizability of atoms and molecules, you see here that iodine is very much more polarizable than bromine, than chlorine, and fluorine is hardly polarizable at all. So that either with a dipole inducing a charge in the other one and being attractive, or just the normal correlation energy, right? Both of those will give rise to greater cohesion with the more polarizable atoms. Notice that methane is, of course, not polar, but it's also not very polarizable, only 2.59 for the molecule as a whole. Now let's look at a few other hydrocarbons down here. So butane, or branched butane, pentane, or highly branched pentane. Neopentane, remember, is a carbon with four methyl groups on it. Okay? And notice that their polarizability is not very different. Right, they're not polar, and they're not very polarizable. But if the polarizability was determining it, and you compared the two butanes with one another, to the extent that these numbers are believable, you'd say that, well, they're really practically the same. They should have the same boiling point. But the N-butane is just slightly more polarizable, so it might be slightly more cohesive and higher boiling. But in the case of the pentane, the neopentane, the one that's a carbon with a spherical thing with four methyls around it, is a little bit more polarizable than the straight chain pentane, so it should be higher boiling. Now let's look at the data here. First, the butanes. You see that indeed isobutane is lower boiling than N-butane. Okay? But let's look at the pentanes. The straight chain pentane is 36. If it has a branch in it, it's 28. And if it's that one that's spherical with four methyl groups around a carbon, it's the lowest boiling, not the highest, which is what you would have predicted from the polarizability. So it's not just the polarizability straight up. You have to be a little more sophisticated in looking at it. So the polarizability, remember, is very sensitive to distance. Right? So you have this in all these isomers of pentane, you have the same number of carbons and hydrogens and of carbon-carbon bonds and carbon-hydrogen bonds. But in in the spherical one, some of the material is down in the middle. Whereas in the straight chain, it's all out in a row. So if you try to get two molecules near one another, you can get atoms nearer atoms if you have straight chains and can put them side by side than if you have two balls and try to get them near one another. Right? Because it's so sensitive to distance. Remember, it depends on the sixth power of the distance. So it's only the atoms that are near the surface that really make a difference, where they can touch, where they can get really close to other molecules. So that's why neopentane is so volatile. Right? If you look at the heat of formation of the molecules in the gas phase, you can see that neopentane is the most stable, but that has to do with hybridization and things. So that, but if you compare that with the ions, you can see that we can say that in a sense these methyl groups around other things in the same molecule are acting as solvents. Right? So if we look at the ions here, in the gas phase, how hard is it to break chlorine ion away from R plus? So how stable is R plus in the gas phase? You can see that it's very hard to make methyl cation, but the ethyl cation is much more stable, and the T-butyl cation is more stable still. Now we've talked about factors that influence this, like hyperconjugation and the difference of sp squared versus sp cubed. But there's another factor going on here that we haven't talked about before, which is just having extra material near where you're putting a positive charge will give the polarizability of the groups is as if there were a solvent around that cation, making it more stable. You see what I mean? The same mechanism of stability, the charge inducing a dipole, shifting the electrons in the other group, leads to stability. So that's an important distinction between gas phase and solution. In solution, you have these other molecules around that can become polarized. But if you have a big cation, they can't do that as well, because the molecules, the other groups within the cation itself, are acting as a solvent. So when people talk about ionic chemistry, often they say if you do it in the gas phase, it's the intrinsic, the fundamental behavior of the molecules. But it's not so obvious that's a proper comparison, because almost anything you're interested in is a solvent. Is almost all the reactions of interest are in a solvent. So what you should compare with, this is the old compared to what question, is not so obvious. And the dramatic difference among these ions in the gas phase could, in a way, be thought of as intramolecular solvation, that you have solvent around from the groups that are in the cation itself, or that mode of stabilization. Now here are boiling points for a lot of other alkanes and alkyl halides. In the previous slide we were just looking at methyl. But here we look at it as we get a longer chain. And in the particular textbook I took this out of, plotted it as a function of molecular weight. And intuitively it makes sense that when things are heavy they don't go into the gas phase. But in fact, that has nothing whatever to do with it. It's not how heavy they are, it's how tightly they hold together. Right? And a better way, in my view, of plotting this is not to use the molecular weight horizontally the way it is done here, because molecular weight has very little to do with boiling point. And a more informative way of plotting it is to have molecules of the same size, the same shape. So we have a straight chain of a certain length with an X on the end. If the X is H, this is the boiling points. And the more groups you have in the chain, the more interaction there is between neighboring molecules, and the less likely they are to go into the gas phase. Fluorine, you notice, is almost the same, because remember, fluorine, although it's polar, is very little polarizable. So when you have a really short one and there are a lot of C fluorines in there, then it's a little bit higher boiling because of the the dipoles interacting with one another. But once they get diluted, then the effect disappears. So the fluorocarbons are pretty much like hydrocarbons. And here you see that the polarizability is about the same, and the dipole moment is small. Okay. Now, if you go to chlorine, the dipole moment isn't very much bigger, but the polarizability is much bigger. So substituting chlorine for fluorine makes the boiling points higher. And then if you do bromine, it's more polarizable still, 6 instead of 5, and iodine is the most polarizable of all, 8. So that's what's holding the molecules together, is this polarizability making the difference among the different halogens. Now, there's the old saw that like dissolves like. And that's related to, you know, what you see in chicken soup or whatever. You see little globs of fat floating around in the water. And what more sophisticated term is often used to talk about this? I think some of you in biology or maybe in chemistry have talked about the effect that makes water bead up in a oil or oil bead up in water. Do you remember what it's called? It's called the hydrophobic effect. The idea that fats are afraid or don't like to be with water. So they tend to gather together, right? And that's very important in how cells are structured and so on. So this so-called hydrophobic effect is more general. Sometimes it's called solvophobic because there can be other solvents besides water that are involved. Now this is drops of mercury on a sheet of glass, right? And you've seen probably mercury bead up, or maybe you haven't, since it's so dangerous nowadays that it didn't used to be dangerous. You could see this all the time when you broke a thermometer, but they don't have that kind anymore. But anyhow, mercury beads up. I think you know that. So there's mercury. It doesn't wet glass. Okay, it doesn't spread out on glass. So these are sometimes called solvophobic forces. Things want to avoid one another is the implication of such a name. But actually, that's not a very good way to describe it, I think, and I'll show you what I mean. So here's a drop of mercury on a little bit of a polyethylene cap that I cut the top off of, and it beads up. So that says that mercury does not wet the hydrocarbon. So they don't want to touch one another, okay? It beads up. So it's like this hydrophobic effect. Now, it turns out that on polyethylene, water doesn't wet it either. Water beads up. So water likes to avoid the polyethylene. Now I want you to make a prediction. How about if I touch the drop of water to the drop of mercury? What's going to happen? Will the mercury spread around the water? Will the water spread around the mercury? Or will they remain as beads that just touch one another the way they do when they're touching polyethylene? So if we say that they're solvophobic forces, that things tend to stay away from one another, then mercury stays away from the polyethylene, water stays away from the polyethylene. I wouldn't be surprised if you predicted that water would stay away from mercury and that they would bead up on one another. I should have had an election about this first to get you. But I did it with my colleagues, and a lot of people said that they'd bead up. But look what happens if you touch water to mercury, right? The mercury doesn't change its shape, but the water changes its shape. The mercury is hydrophilic. It wants to be near the water wants to be near the mercury, right? It wants to spread out on the mercury. Here's another picture where it's in a little time later it had spread out on the drop of mercury, right? So mercury attracts water. So it's not a question of repelling things from this idea of phobic. It's a question of attracting. Okay, so alkanes and water, alkane, polyethylene is an alkane, or mercury and glass do not repel one another, right? But mercury has good reason to be near mercury and water near water. Why do mercury atoms want to be near mercury? They form bonds, metallic. It's a metal, after all, right? But also, they're very polarizable. So the mechanism by which mercury sticks to mercury is polarizability. And that's why it beads up. So you can get as many mercuries close to other mercuries as possible. Minimize the surface, right, where mercury is next to air or next to anything else. Maximize the number of mercury-mercury contacts, which you get by making it a ball. And water has good reason to be near water. What's that? It's the dipole-dipole, not polarizability, but dipole-dipole mostly, that holds water together. Okay, but mercury is not dipolar, so water won't stick to mercury because of dipole-dipole interactions, right? But still, mercury is so polarizable that there's good attraction between mercury and water. Mercury wants water to come near it. Right? But even more, mercury wants to be near mercury. So mercury stays spherical, but water is more attracted to mercury than it's attracted to water. So it spreads out on mercury to get more contact between water and mercury. So there's a good example of the importance of polarizability in these intermolecular interactions. Now, with respect to the water wanting to be near water, and incidentally, the solvophobic in general, why water beads up on hydrocarbon, is because water has a way of attracting water that it doesn't have of attracting the hydrocarbon, the dipole interaction between water molecules. So just like the mercury, the water molecules want to be as much as possible in contact with other molecules, other water molecules, that is to be spherical. They don't want to spread out, losing contact of water with water and gaining only contact of water with a hydrocarbon, which isn't as good an interaction. Now, with respect to the interaction of water dipoles, what would you expect if we brought another water molecule next to this one? How do you think it should line up? Sunny? Well, I would think that it turns out you're right. But if it were just dipoles, like magnets, they want to line up head to tail, like this, right? That's the way magnets line up. The dipoles should be parallel to one another. So if you rotated another one, it should line up like that. You see what I'm saying? But in fact, you're right. The way the true water molecule, water dimer, is arranged is this. Right? But that looks sort of funny. Not only does this hydrogen on the right point more or less toward an oxygen, right? But the water on the left doesn't have its symmetry axis pointing toward that hydrogen. Now, why could that be? It could be that it's forming a bond, a homo-lumo interaction, where the unshared pair on the oxygen on the left is mixing with the sigma star OH bond, okay? But if you look at the distances between hydrogen and oxygen, these are the normal ones. The one that would have been involved in a bond, or a pseudo-bond, is hardly any longer at all. It's not like you put electron density into the anti-bonding orbital there, or at least no significant. It's lengthened by only 0.5%. So there's not much actual bonding going on. It's mostly these electrostatic interactions. So there's not much sigma star involvement, right? But if you look at the water, not just as a dipole, but in the overall distribution of charge, so there's water in one orientation. This is the one that we're interested in, the H. And if you look at the surface and see what the surface potential is, which, remember, is how high is the energy of a proton put at different positions on the van der Waals surface, you see that the low energy for let's see which one I've got my signs mixed up let's make the scale such that we see more dramatically the differences. And you see that, yeah, so the high energy place for a proton to be, the high surface potential, plus 50, which is hidden under the number there, is right opposite the H. Okay, so that's where you would expect to put a thing that's that's not a positive charge. It would be high energy, but negative charge of the other molecule would tend to be there. Now, where is the negative charge on the surface of a water molecule? Well, here's a water molecule, and here's the surface potential. Looking now at where the negative charge would be, and if we change the scale for the colors so that we can see small differences, you see something interesting. It's at the oxygen, indeed, but it gets especially strong on the oxygen, not along the symmetry axis this way, but a little bit above and a little bit below. The maximum positive, the maximum negative charge is a little above and a little below, as if it were two unshared pairs coming out, right? So if you want to get these things so that they get the maximum touching of positive with negative charge on their surfaces, you don't want to touch this oxygen at the along its axis. You want to touch it here, right? And that's indeed what happens. Right, that you come at you approach the oxygen molecule on the left, not along its symmetry axis, but a little bit away, where the negative charge on the surface is concentrated. Okay, so that just says that talking about dipoles is a little bit too much of a simplification. If you want to see these interactions in their greatest generality, you have to look at more detail about how the charge is distributed over the surface. Okay, now, the thing that's special about hydrogen bonds, they're not covalent bonds, it's not a homo-lumo thing we saw here, but the thing that allows them to be stronger than other dipole interactions is that hydrogen is so very small, right? So you can approach very close to hydrogen, right? So that OH to OH bond is worth calling a hydrogen bond, whereas other dipoles, when they approach one another, you don't call them a chlorine bond or something like that, because those atoms are bigger and you can't get so close to them, and the electrostatic energy which falls off so rapidly with distance is not big enough. So typically, these hydrogen bonds are about 5% as strong as a covalent bond. So covalent bonds are the big story, and that's what allows us, as I said earlier, to discuss organic chemistry in terms of molecules. But enough of these things like hydrogen bonds can sum up to be an important part of a covalent bond, even in terms of energy. Now, in section 610, talks about crown ethers and what I've labeled tailored ionophores. For means to carry, right? So an ionophore is a thing that carries ions. These ionophores are things that can carry ions into regions where the ions would not normally be stabilized. That is, where you don't have a high dielectric constant of the solvent, into a hydrocarbon or through the wall of a cell where you have just hydrocarbon surrounding. Now, these things were the subject of the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1987, and the classic among them is this so-called crown ether. Probably the same person that thought up the name chair for cyclohexane thought up the name crown for this thing. It doesn't look very much like a crown to me. But these ethers that are polyethers that have CH2CH2O, 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 various sizes of rings, are called crown ethers. And their names are abbreviated by giving the size of the ring as a whole, 18 in this case, then crown, C, and then how many oxygens there are, 6. So 18 crown 6. Now let's look at some structures of 18 crown 6 being used to interact with ions. Okay, so first 18 crown 6 reacting with potassium chloride. Right, so there it is, it just surrounds. Notice that three of the oxygens you see well, and three of the oxygens you can only see a little bit. That's because the oxygens in the middle alternate going up, down, like the carbons in cyclohexane, right? But they can all. But the potassium ion fits very comfortably in the middle. I have a picture taken from the side that shows again the oxygens going up and down, the potassium purple in the middle, and chloride nearby. Now, when you try to get it's difficult to dissolve sodium chloride, say, in a solvent that doesn't have a really high dielectric constant like water, because it takes so much energy to get the ions apart from one another, right? If the ions were really big, then they'd be intrinsically far apart from one another, right? And they wouldn't have nearly as low an energy to begin with in the crystal. Right? So the crystal wouldn't be as stable, and the chance of getting apart from one another would be larger. So if you can wrap one of these crown ethers around an ion and make the ion effectively be much larger, then it'll be more likely to dissolve in a solvent that's not like water or something that has a high dielectric constant. So there's how potassium fits in 18 crown 6. Right, and there's a picture of it, and there you can again see that it's a little bit like cyclohexane, although not as puckered. Okay, there again. Okay, and there are the distances. They're all just about right for the sum of the distance for the radius of a potassium ion and the van der Waals radius of oxygen. So the sum of those two radii is 2.73, and the distances are just very close to that. Now, how about if we take a different cation like cesium that's much bigger? Here's the picture from the X-ray structure of cesium with 18 crown 6. And here it is from the side. The cesium can't get down in the middle, right? It's too big. There it is looked at from the other side. You see it's on one face, not on the other. Okay, and here it is again. And if we look at the distances and compare them with the distances to the ones that are further away, you see that the white ones are near the sum of the van der Waals radii. So they're in contact with the oxygens, but three of the oxygens are much further away and not stabilizing the cesium as well. Okay? Or if you get a smaller ion, here's sodium instead of the original potassium. Now, in order to optimize its structure, the ring puckers to try to get things closer to the small sodium ion. So the sum of the van der Waals radii is about 2.4, and only one of those distances shown here is that close. The others the ion is essentially sort of rattling in the cage now, not making good contact. Although it bent one side of the ring down to come underneath so that it got as close, but only two of them are now close, right? And in fact, there's now room for water on the top. This is a hydrate, and that's at the normal van der Waals radii. Okay. Or lithium is even worse. Now the lithium ion is way over on one side, right? And those those two are in contact, but the others are too far away. In fact, the molecule is clever and puts, whereas those distances would be way too big, it puts two waters in there. So the waters have a close distance to the lithium, and then they can hydrogen bond to those other oxygens, like that. Okay, so now you can look at the equilibrium constant for binding between these things. Except, let's see, I've used the time up. So next time we'll talk about the equilibrium constant for 18 crown 6 binding with these different cations. Okay. So see John if you want to get your copy of the textbook.
Could you only use 18 crown 6? Are there other?
Oh no, there are hundreds and hundreds of these things with different atoms in them and different ring sizes.
So you use like a smaller ring for.
And I'll show you that next time.
Okay.
Yeah.